lot of things, I see now a lot of things that went into me, into my head, and thinking that these were perhaps changing and altering things. It's, I see and hear very clearly.
Est-ce que vous allez faire un album comme celui de Moore? Est-ce qu'il est commencé? Le film est terminé, l'album n'est pas encore commencé.
Au cœur de la Nouvelle-Guinée, une des plus grandes îles du monde.
In early 1972, Pink Floyd were in the middle of creating one of the most successful and iconic albums in history when they took an unexpected, but perhaps welcome break, flew to France, and there, wrote and recorded an entirely separate album in just 2 weeks. Also, that very same month, February of 1972, Pink Floyd's enigmatic founding member, Syd Barrett, surprisingly resurfaced, fronting a new band.
Now the look of the week.
Those sounds were made by the Pink Floyd, a pop group who took over the Queen Elizabeth Hall on Friday night for the entertainment they called Games for May. Of them, more hereafter.
I'm not a doctor, so I can't really say what LSD specifically does or what it did to Syd or what it exacerbated in Syd.
He was undergoing all this sort of stress of coming to terms with fame, and I think he was just overwhelmed by it.
She did try and get him to see doctors and this sort of thing, but to no avail.
He just had lost interest in it, and Syd actually underwent a sort of conscience crisis that this wasn't art. It was becoming so commercial with television and record sales, and he had been an art student and still painted and had a fairly rigorous view of how one should behave as an artist. And I think that just meant this was not really what he wanted to do.
I think he had nightmares, I mean, real living nightmares.
We were so determined to carry on that we probably all pretended that he was a bit better, because actually Syd was the writer, he was the front man. The last thing we needed was to lose Syd.
His behaviour before the American tour was getting a bit tricky, but it got really bad in America.
He had to get pretty sort of difficult before we considered doing it without him. And, you know, I think that perhaps is the regret, that we dragged him along for longer than we ever should have done.
When he came back from America, that had a real shocking effect. It was after that that we started getting worried about his mental health. And it was all very upsetting. And, of course, it was all upsetting our business because it meant we were becoming quite unreliable, you know.
It was such a hectic, busy time. There were times when it was impossible for him to play, and there were other times when, he's singing, he's playing.
There came a point where what was avant-garde became a bit disturbing, and when it was playing the same note all the way through, it became clearly a bit weird. None of us had any experience of what was going on. It was, you know, we had no idea how to cope with it.
But I think they did try to help him. I remember hearing that they did take him to a psychiatric hospital. They sort of took him and dumped him on the doorstep, but of course he just left. But he was terribly stubborn, always about everything, so I don't blame them at all.
Syd Barrett's exit from Pink Floyd was long and drawn out and torturous for everyone involved. It was Syd's band. He named it. He fronted it. Floyd was his vision, his dream, but he sabotaged it, consciously or subconsciously, on purpose or because he couldn't help it. Syd grew more and more unpredictable and unreliable. Pink Floyd, eventually, reluctantly, was forced to move on without him. It would definitely be a different band without Syd Barrett, but Pink Floyd would remain quite eccentric and experimental, at least for a while. Side one of their 1970 album Atom Heart Mother is one long, challenging piece of music. Side two of the next year's Metal is one long, challenging piece of music. But for their next album, Pink Floyd decided they wanted to simplify their approach. They decided, or Roger Waters decided, that the next album would have an overriding theme or themes that would tie it all together. The whole endeavor would be more focused. They'd tell a story, deliver a message, make a statement, something substantial, and they'd put it across with concise, structured, accessible songs. Roger Waters described it as, quote, coming down to earth a bit, or, as David Gilmour put it, quote, I remember Roger saying that he wanted to write it absolutely straight, clear, and direct, to say exactly what he wanted to say for the first time, and get away from psychedelic patter and strange and mysterious warblings. But what would this album be about? The band members compiled a list of topics that troubled them, issues they'd maybe like to grapple with, or at least address in some way. The list ranged from simple boredom to fear of flying, age or getting old, religion, violence, greed, and hearkening back to their struggles with Syd, mental illness. By February, the majority of the material had come together and the band started playing the entire sequence live, over a year before the record would actually come out. Pink Floyd performed the material live multiple times over the course of the next number of months, refining it in front of a live audience. As drummer Nick Mason explained, quote, it was a hell of a good way to develop a record. You really get familiar with it. You learn the pieces you like and what you don't like. It was also in February of 1972, right when Pink Floyd were debuting this new material live, the material that would become The Dark Side of the Moon, when Syd Barrett reappeared. His new band was a trio they called Stars. The band consisted of Syd and the rhythm section, bassist Jack Monk, and a drummer named Twink. Twink had played in a British psychedelic band called Tomorrow with Steve Howe, later of Yes, and he was also a member of the infamous Pink Fairies. Jack Monk was married to an ex-girlfriend of Syd's named Jenny Spire. After Pink Floyd had stopped inviting him to rehearsals, Syd Barrett had recorded two meandering solo albums and then made several attempts at returning to the concert stage. His first solo performance took place on June 6, 1970, at London's Olympia Exhibition Hall, backed up by his Pink Floyd replacement David Gilmour on bass and Humble Pie drummer Jerry Shirley, both of whom had assisted Syd in the recording of his solo albums. The gig at Olympia Exhibition Hall was marred by technical difficulties. Barrett performed just four songs before laying his guitar down on the stage and abruptly walking off. You can hear that moment at the end of this next clip. Syd Barrett would not perform in public again until January 26, 1972, when he was spotted in the audience while attending a concert by American blues musician Eddie Guitar Burns and invited on stage.
We'd like to bring Syd Barrett up to the bandstand. Would you come on? How about a hand for Syd Barrett, huh?
Syd jammed for 30 minutes with Burns' backing group, who were calling themselves the Last Minute Put Together Boogie Band. The experience proved pleasant enough, and Syd joined the band on stage again the next day as a special guest for three songs.
It was a gospel group back in the States, and I picked up this one song. It's called Drinking That Wine. And if you want to clap along with it, you know, it's a funky going to church, getting drunk on the holy wine, right? When Jesus started his disciples, you know just how to keep them in line. First thing when I did, I
Jack Monk and Twink were members of the last-minute put-together boogie band. Seeing the opportunity to capitalize on Syd Barrett's reemergence, Jenny Speier, Jack Monk's wife and Syd's ex-girlfriend, urged Jack and Twink to put a new band together with Syd. This is how Twink remembered it. Quote, "We went round to his house, and Syd came to the door, and Jenny said, 'Jack and Twink were thinking it would be nice to form a band, just the three of you.' So he said, 'Yeah, all right, come in.' And that was that. We started rehearsing down in the basement of his house. That's how it started. We were doing all of Syd's stuff, old material like Lucifer Sam. We did about half a dozen gigs. I think it was a pretty tight set, but some of the gigs were kind of loose, because we didn't have road managers. We just had people helping out and stuff. We played all around the Cambridge area, didn't go out of Cambridge, just places like coffee bars, and we played the Market Square. That was the most memorable gig. It was a good gig, it was really brilliant." Starr's debut live performance happened on February 5th, 1972, with an impromptu performance at the Dandelion Coffee Bar in Cambridge. The Starr's live set consisted of Syd Barrett-era Pink Floyd songs and tracks from Barrett's two 1970s solo albums, The Madcap Laughs and Barrett. On February 24th, Starr's opened for MC5 at the Cambridge Corn Exchange. It was the band's fifth gig, and it was a disaster. The set was plagued with sound problems, and Barrett sliced his finger on a guitar string. The set ended prematurely when Jack Monk's bass amp stopped working.
I remember looking across at Syd and just thinking, you don't want to be here, do you? He was kind of like going through the motions. The mic was here and he'd just sort of be singing like this, and everybody just knew that the wheels had come off. You were just witnessing the breakdown of someone in performance. Some gigs are good and some are bad, some are really bad, and that was probably the worst.
Starr's played only one more gig 2 days later, opening for prog band Nectar at the same venue, the Cambridge Corn Exchange. This gig reportedly went better, but when Syd Barrett read a scathing review of the MC5 appearance in Melody Maker, he forsook the limelight again and retreated back into the shadows. A quote from Twink, "Syd was really hung up about it. He said he didn't want to play anymore." Starr's roadie Joel E. McPhee remembers it this way, quote, "The promoter of these shows, Steve Brink, had promised that there would be no press. However, he did invite a guy from the Melody Maker, Roy Hollingworth, who had some sort of nervous breakdown at the MC5 show. He wrote a piece that came out the next Wednesday detailing a wave of absolute alienation he sensed at the show, and used Syd as a metaphor for it." Let's hear an excerpt from that review, published in Melody Maker on March 4th, 1972.
"He played a demented solo that ran ragged lines of up to 10 minutes. His raggled hair fell over a face that fell over a guitar and seldom looked up. He changed time almost by the minute. The keys and chords made little sense. The fingers on his left hand met the frets like strangers. They formed chords, reformed them, apparently nearly got it right, and then wandered away again. Then Syd scratched his nose and let loose a very short sigh. It was like watching somebody piece together a memory that had suffered the most severe shell shock. I don't know how much Syd Barrett remembered, but he didn't give in. Even though he lost his bassist and even though Twink couldn't share Sid's journey, Syd played on. He has a beard now, but his eyes are still deep cavities hiding an inexplicable vision. Tuning up presents awkward problems. He holds his guitar like he's never held a guitar before. He keeps scratching his nose. Madcap Laughs opened the set. It didn't sound much like it used to, but Sid's voice did. A well-spoken whine. The chords are out of tune and he keeps looking to his right and sort of scowling at Twink and the bassist, as though in disagreement."
So Starr's was done. After barely a month together and only 6 gigs, no original songs. It was a feeble attempt by Syd, but it was an attempt, with quality musicians and high-profile opening spots in front of big crowds. It does seem as if Syd wanted to make a comeback. He just couldn't. Soon after, in May of 1972, Syd Barrett signed a document that officially ended his association with Pink Floyd, including any financial interest he might have been able to claim in any future recordings by the band, and he retreated back into obscurity. Meanwhile, the new, high-concept Pink Floyd album, some of which would seemingly reference Syd Barrett's very real struggle with mental illness, was being recorded. It would take 40 days, but spread out over 7 months.
Dark Side of the Moon is about the tendency towards madness that is brought upon one by the pressures of life. And obviously, to me, Dark Side of the Moon is definitely very, very influenced by Syd's condition.
This time they were working with a real producer, Chris Thomas, someone who could help reel them in and help them make a more straightforward, more easily digestible, more relatable record. Engineer Alan Parsons also played a major role in sculpting the album, tying it all together with sound effects and background noise. The plan was to call the record The Dark Side of the Moon. Then, in the middle of the recording, a blues rock band called Medicine Head came out with a record called Dark Side of the Moon. The disappointed band changed their record's title to Eclipse, but once they realized that the Medicine Head record had barely made a blip on the radar, they said fuck it and reclaimed their title.
You're in a corner with your back to the wall. When you speak, I hear nothing at all. I make a change, put everything right. Don't keep your feels down out of sight. Gotta put our feelings in the right place. See that living just ain't pretty late. I see the trees and you see the sky. Everything can help you to get high.
So there they were in the middle of creating Dark Side of the Moon when French film director Barbe Schroeder, for whom they had previously scored the film More, called again, requesting another score for his new film, La Valley. This is a description of the film from Mark Blake's book, Comfortably Numb. La Valley itself was another spiritual quest in the style of Moore. The female lead, Vivian, is married to a French diplomat and visits the island of Papua New Guinea in search of rare bird's feathers to sell in her Paris boutique. She becomes distracted by a hippie explorer, Olivier, and joins him to search for a mystical valley marked on a map with the words obscured by clouds. They encounter the indigenous people. She ditches her materialistic obsessions and most of her clothes and is somehow reborn. And so, heeding Schroeder's call, the band took a welcome break, presumably, from their immersion in the Dark Side of the Moon and flew to France, hunkered down in Strawberry Studios on the outskirts of Paris, and went about writing and recording an entirely separate album in just 2 one-week sessions, with a short tour of Japan in between. The new album was entirely written and recorded from February 3rd to the 29th and March 23rd to the 27th. Meanwhile, The Dark Side of the Moon, in progress, waited to be finished. A quote from David Gilmour: "It was rapid stuff. We sat in a room, wrote, recorded, like a production line. Very good to work like that sometimes, under extreme constraints of time and trying to meet someone else's needs." As they had done with Schroeder's previous film, More, the band saw a rough cut of La Valley and noted certain timings for cues with a stopwatch. From this, they created a number of pieces that they felt could be cross-faded at various points in the final cut of the film. They were not worried about creating complete songs, feeling that any musical piece would be workable without the need for any solos. But nevertheless, under pressure to produce enough material for a full album, they managed to create a whole series of well-structured songs. The band had a disagreement with the film company distributing La Valley and decided to release the album as Obscured by Clouds instead of as a branded soundtrack to La Valley. In response, the production company released the film under both titles, La Valley and Obscured by Clouds. Obscured by Clouds was released on June 2, 1972. On that same day, Pink Floyd were ensconced in Abbey Road Studios working on The Dark Side of the Moon. The Obscured by Clouds cover was designed by Storm Thorgerson and Aubrey Powell of Hypnosis and consisted of a still from the film, a man sitting in a tree, but out of focus to the point of complete distortion. Obscured by Clouds did manage to enter the top 10 in the UK, but it was barely noticed in the United States. Rolling Stone called it a dull film soundtrack, and Robert Christgau wrote, quote, "The movie got buried, now skip the soundtrack." The Dark Side of the Moon came out less than a year later, on March 1, 1973, and it was an instant hit in the UK, but it also went to number one in the United States, and famously remained a fixture on the Billboard charts for decades. The album has racked up more than 900 weeks in the Billboard Top 200 and sold more than 45 million copies worldwide. Obscured by Clouds was certified gold in the U.S. in 1994. Postscript. In August 1974, while Pink Floyd were out on what they called the Brain Damage Tour, off playing to huge crowds in Germany, Switzerland, and Italy, Sid Barrett, like Gollum in search of his precious, again crept out of hiding. He booked time at Abbey Road Studios. The sessions lasted only 3 days and consisted of blues rhythm tracks with tentative and disjointed guitar overdubs. Barrett started work on 11 different potential songs, but only one of them was even given a title. It was called If You Go, Don't Be Slow. Thank you. Those 3 days at Abbey Road in 1974 were Syd Barrett's final attempt. Afterwards, he withdrew from the music industry completely. He sold the rights to his solo albums back to the record label and moved into a London hotel. In 1976, both The Damned and The Sex Pistols asked Syd Barrett to produce their albums. This was the moment of truth for punk rock in England. Producing either or both of those records was an amazing opportunity and could have been, should have been, a launching point for a whole new career for Syd Barrett as a record producer. But he declined.
Explains how Sid Vicious got his name.
The name does come from Syd Barrett of Pink Floyd fame. Remember?
I do very well. Very well.
Well, we called him Vicious because he wasn't vicious. He's just a big baby who eats sweets. Look at him.
I thought you called him Sid because that was an albino hamster that you had both owned.
Yeah, that was why I was called Sid, because I hated them. I always was going on
but that's
to John
his real
about,
name now.
About how I hated the name Sid. So he started calling me Sid to all my friends and saying, look, this is Sid. And I made the big mistake of denying it and saying, it's not, honestly, it's so-and-so. And I was Sid forever after, so I thought, well, I'm stuck with it now, so I might as well like it.
And do you?
Yeah.
Of course I like Pink Floyd. I don't hate Pink Floyd. I actually really love Pink Floyd. Arnold Lane comes to mind, all these things, and Syd Barrett, you know, was one of the original writers. And I've got to tell you, John Beverley got the nickname Sid because of Syd Barrett. I called John Sid. There you go. Pistol history. Early Pink Floyd, fantastic. And they ain't been bad for their entire period.
The album Obscured by Clouds was a lark for Pink Floyd. The Dark Side of the Moon had turned into a massive undertaking, the result of much forethought and planning. The Dark Side of the Moon was meticulously created, piece by piece. Obscured by Clouds, on the other hand, was a spontaneous creation. No planning, just a burst of creativity. It must have been fun for the band to do, to just make a record quickly, randomly, short melodic songs, no lofty goals or expectations. It must have been a relief to make a record just for the hell of it, considering how immersed they had been in making The Dark Side of the Moon. I think Obscured by Clouds is a great album, and it's pretty astonishing that Pink Floyd wrote and recorded it all in just 2 weeks and with no forethought. The album opens with two instrumental pieces which are pretty interesting, and then we get three great songs right in a row: Burning Bridges, The Gold It's In The, and What's the Deal?
Something they say, I'll get my kicks on the way. Over the sent the promised land. Looks alright from where I stand, 'cause I'm the man on the outside looking in. Waiting on the first step, show me where the key is kept. Point me down to let me in from the cold. Turn my leg into gold, 'cause there's a chill wind blowing in my soul, and I think I'm going home. Flash the red is what's a deal, got to make it to the next meal. Try to keep up with the turning of the wheel. Mile after mile, stone after stone, it's time to speak that you're alone.
Side 2 of Obscured by Clouds opens with a great David Gilmour written rocker called Childhood's End. It was the last Pink Floyd song released to have lyrics written by Gilmour until a momentary lapse of reason in 1987. Childhood's End was performed live at a few gigs in 1972 and early in 1973, and the drum pattern that opens the track was recycled for the song Time on the Dark Side of the Moon. Let's close out the episode with what is probably my favorite song from Obscured by Clouds, an excellent Roger Waters acoustic tune called Free Four. The song includes Roger's very first reference to his father's death in World War II. This would become a major overriding theme on The Wall and The Final Cut. The song also references life on the road and the drawbacks of touring, another theme that Waters would explore with The Wall. Interestingly, the version of the song played in the film, La Vallée, has a different third verse. Free 4 was actually released as a single in the US.
1, 2, 3, 4! Memories of a man in his old age are the deeds of a man in his prime. You shuffle in the gloom of the sick room and talk to yourself as you die. And life is a short, warm moment, and death is a long, cold rest. Get your chance to try in a twinkling of an eye, 80 years with luck or even less. So all aboard for the American tour, and maybe you'll make it to the top. But mind how you go, and I can tell you, 'cause I know you may find it hard to get off.
Sid appears in the wall a lot, you know, which is where, you know, in the movie where the cigarette burns down between the fingers? Well, I went into the room and saw that. My friendship with him and his illness combined, yeah, provide an enormous opportunity for grief. It's sad. It's very sad. I'm still very sad about it, you know.
The spectre of Sid haunted us subsequently. I mean, obviously, we went back to it you know, with Wish You Were Here, in a major way.
That was me strumming a 12-string guitar, which I'd recently purchased from a guy I know, and coming up with, you know, the opening riff of Wish You Were Here. And again, like the four notes at the beginning of Shine On You Crazy Diamond, other people start going, hey, that's good, you got something there.
And I said to him, what's that you're playing? That's really nice. And he played it. And I said, that's really good. Maybe I should try and do something with it.
I think Roger and I then worked on writing the verses and putting those chords into the whole thing, and Roger did those brilliant words, and there we are.
And did they get you to trade your heroes for ghosts, hot ashes for trees, hot air for cool breeze, cold comfort for change? And did you exchange a walk-on part in the wall for a lead role in the cage?
That collaboration between David and I think is, you know, really good.
Think you can tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail, a smile from a veil? Do you think you can tell?
Thank you.
the famous day when Sid came to the Wish You Were Here sessions, he was shaved, you know. I had no idea who he was for a long time, and neither did anybody else, I didn't think, for a while.
Just ask you about that. Was that the last time you saw him, actually?
Yeah. No. I saw him again once in Harrods. I was in Harrods, shopping, and I saw Sid.
Did he recognise you?
I don't think he saw me. I saw him. He had his brown paper bag. He was, you know, buying sweets. Because I think he just lived on sweets. He used to live in...
Chelsea Cloisters, was it?
No, before that, he lived in the Hilton Hotel for a long time. He had a sort of suite of rooms and stuff where he would sit and eat. He spent, you know, far too much of his money doing that. And then he eventually moved from there. That's the last time I saw him.
Just going back to the wall, that... Were you saying in that it's almost like this, you know, it could have happened to you. You had similar kind of experiences in life to some extent, with fathers dying young and the same kind of education. And was it like almost like, for the grace of God, there go I, you know, this sort of closeness of madness?
Well, not... Yeah, maybe.